December 10th, 1999, Los Angeles, California. After attending a party at the Dykstra Hall dormitory, Michael Negrete, an 18-year-old freshman at UCLA, spends a few hours playing an online video game on his computer with a friend and is last seen at around 4 a.m. Hours later, Mike's roommate wakes up and discovers that he is gone from the room and has left behind his wallet and his keys. There's some intriguing leads, such as a bloodhound tracking Mike's scent to a bus stop, and an eyewitness sighting of an unidentified man in the dorm around the time Mike went missing, but no trace of him is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today, we're going to explore one of the most baffling missing persons cases of the modern era, the 1999 disappearance of Michael Negrete. Ever since the inception of this podcast, I've received numerous requests to cover this mystery, because it almost seems like one of those disappearances where the victim literally vanished into thin air. Michael Negrete was a freshman at UCLA who was preparing for the semester's exams before the holiday break, and after attending a party at his dormitory and playing an online video game in his dorm room until the wee hours of the morning, he inexplicably vanished without a trace. But what makes Mike's disappearance particularly bizarre is that he left all of his personal possessions behind in his room, including his wallet and his keys. It seems very unlikely that Mike could have been abducted from a crowded dormitory without anyone seeing or hearing anything, and since a police bloodhound tracked Mike's scent to a bus stop, this does seem to suggest that he left the dorm on his own accord, but why would he do so at that time of the morning and not take his keys with him? This is one case in which there has been a lot of unconfirmed speculation about what might have happened to Mike, including the possibility that his disappearance was somehow related to drugs, but there is almost nothing in the way of actual hard evidence. The case has also been plagued by a lot of rumors and misinformation being spread around so much online that they are often mistakenly believed to be facts, so I'm going to try and address some of these issues on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the perplexing disappearance of Michael Negrete. Our story begins in California in 1999, and our central figure is 18-year-old Michael William Negrete, who goes by the name Mike. Mike was originally born in Virginia, but grew up in the Silver Springs community of San Diego with his parents, Miguel and Mary Negrete, along with his two younger brothers, 14-year-old Stephen and 16-year-old David. After graduating with honors at Rancho Bernardo High School, Mike is now a freshman at the University of California, Los Angeles, aka UCLA, and attending there on a music scholarship. Mike loves jazz music and is particularly skilled at the trumpet, as he once won a trophy for Outstanding Soloist at the Coronado Jazz Festival. In addition to the trumpet, Mike is also learning how to play the steel drums, and is part of a band called Island Fever, who have performed at such places as the San Diego Zoo. While the other members of Island Fever are older than Mike, they allowed him to join their band at a young age because of his talent and dependability. During his first semester at UCLA, Mike has gotten good grades in his classes and made a number of new friends. He is currently residing at the Dykstra Hall Dormitory, located on campus near the intersection of Gailey Avenue and Strathmore Boulevard in the Westwood neighborhood. Mike's room is located on the 6th floor of the dorm, and he also has a roommate, and at this particular point, he is preparing for exams. Mike last visited his family at Thanksgiving, and on Thursday, December the 9th, he would email his mother and inform her of his plans to return home for the Christmas holidays on the 15th. Later that evening, Mike played trumpet at a concert before attending a party being held on his dorm floor. The party was attended by about 15 to 20 students and involved drinking margaritas, and sometime during the early morning hours of December the 10th, Mike returned to his room and proceeded to play an online video game on his computer with another friend who lived in the dorm. The game lasted for several hours, and since it was played over the campus's intranet system, records would show that Mike logged off at 3:40 a.m. Sometime around 4 o'clock, Mike left his room in order to congratulate his friend on winning the game, but shortly after this, he would somehow vanish without a trace. We can't be certain if Mike ever returned to his room at any point, as his roommate had been sleeping while all this was going on. The roommate would claim that he woke up later that morning at 9 a.m. and noticed that Mike was not there, and his bed did not appear to have been slept in. But curiously, all of Mike's personal belongings, including his wallet and keys, had been left behind. Now, we'll talk about this in more detail later on in the episode, but many sources state that Mike's shoes were left in his room as well, but this doesn't necessarily mean he did not have on any footwear at the time he went missing. Well, over the next few days, Mike missed a pair of musical engagements, and when he failed to show up for his first exam on Monday, December the 13th, he was officially reported missing to the UCLA Police Department. A police bloodhound was used to track Mike's scent from Dykstra Hall, and the dog would be described as moving in a zigzag pattern while following the scent across the UCLA campus. The scent finally came to an end at a bus stop located at the intersection of Sunset Boulevard and Bellagio Street, which is about a 15 to 20 minute walk from the dorm. While Mike did not own a vehicle, it seemed odd that he would leave his keys and wallet behind in his room in order to catch a bus during the wee hours of the morning, particularly since there were at least three other bus stops on campus which were located much closer to Dykstra Hall. Investigators interviewed a number of riders and drivers who took that particular bus route, but did not turn up any promising leads. It's also been reported that Mike's scent specifically ended at a payphone next to the bus stop, but while investigators did apparently check to see if any calls were made from that phone, it does not appear they found anything. Investigators would also later say that they could not trust the bloodhound's trail because the dog was probably confused, so it's possible this entire lead might be a red herring. Searches were also performed of Dykstra Hall's garbage chute, as well as a number of construction sites located on campus, but they failed to turn up any trace of Mike. Mike's disappearance left everyone completely perplexed, since he did not have any known enemies or personal problems or signs of depression. Since Mike was doing well in school and had told his mother he was planning to return home for the holidays, there did not seem to be any reason for him to disappear voluntarily. Regardless, the Negrete family held out hopes that Mike was still alive somewhere, so shortly before Christmas, they made this public plea to him, quote, "Michael, we love you and want to have you with us on Christmas. Your brothers miss you and are counting on having you back," end quote. But when Mike failed to resurface by the new year, his parents canceled his housing contract at Dykstra Hall and moved his belongings out of his dorm room. Thousands of flyers containing photographs of Mike would be circulated throughout the UCLA campus and the surrounding area, and while a number of Mike's friends and fellow students were questioned, they did not provide much useful information. The Negrete family hired two private investigators, and Mike's band, Island Fever, also held several benefit concerts and fundraisers to help raise money for a Michael Negrete search fund. The Negrete stated that if the money in this fund was never paid out as a reward, they would donate it to the two high schools Mike had attended. The reward they offered for information was initially $5,000, though it eventually skyrocketed to $100,000. Since they had no luck finding Mike, the UCLA Police Department brought in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department to assist them, and they would take control of the investigation. In June of 2000, the Sheriff's Department sent out questionnaires to all residents who were living in Dykstra Hall at the time Mike went missing, and one of them would provide a new lead. A student recalled having seen an unidentified Caucasian man inside Dykstra Hall at around 4:35 a.m. on the morning of December the 10th, which is around the same time Mike vanished. I've also seen sources state that this man reportedly put a newspaper over his face when the student spotted him. The man was described as being approximately 35 years old and around 5'7" or 5'8", with a heavy build, and he was wearing a shiny gray jacket with a turquoise color design. While he was not considered to be a suspect, investigators still wanted to question this guy in case he may have seen something that night, but even though a composite sketch form was created and circulated by the media, this lead never went anywhere. In November of 2000, investigators checked into another lead involving three UCLA students who had lived in Dykstra Hall at the time of Mike's disappearance. By this point, the students were now living in an apartment complex near the campus and reported that they overheard a suspicious phone conversation from another resident of the complex who supposedly shared details about Mike's disappearance which were not public knowledge at that time. They apparently made mention of a missing UCLA student named Mike who had once been in a traffic accident, which was similar to an accident Michael Negrete experienced on a previous occasion. There were around 40 to 45 residents at this complex, but even though they were all interviewed, I do not believe the caller was ever identified, and the lead turned out to be another dead end. In December, the San Diego Union-Tribune published a one-year anniversary article about Mike's disappearance, which confirmed that Dykstra Hall did have a student at the front door who did not see Mike leave that night, and the article also reported that police had not completely discounted a witness who said they had seen someone dressed similar to Mike outside the building at 4:35 a.m. Following his disappearance, there was no activity on Mike's bank account, credit cards, or his club card for the Ralph's supermarket chain, so the authorities found it unlikely that he was still alive and began investigating his death as a potential homicide. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department consulted with a homicide profiler who specialized in statistical data and criminal psychology, and they expressed their belief that investigators may have already interviewed someone who knew what happened to Mike without even realizing it. Mike's story would be featured on numerous TV shows, which included Mary Negrete making an appearance on the Montel Williams show in 2003. While there, she was told by notorious so-called psychic Sylvia Brown that Mike was still alive and residing in the West Los Angeles area near UCLA, and, well, given her history, I'm sure you will not be overwhelmed with shock to hear me say that I wouldn't put much credence into anything that Sylvia Brown said. At one point, there was a promising lead when the username Mike had been using when speaking to people on AOL Instant Messaging, TrainFan1, was suddenly reactivated a few years after he went missing. But it turned out that the username had simply expired due to inactivity, so someone else picked it up, and this person was ruled out as having any involvement in Mike's disappearance. For years, the Negrettis maintained a website about the case at the domain findmikenow.com, but while the site has not been functional for over a decade, it can still be viewed via the Wayback Machine, which archives inactive websites. And while we're on the subject of inactive websites, another interesting development occurred when Mike's brother Steve made a post on his Tumblr page on June the 13th, 2013, and answered a question asking for his stance on casual drinking and drugs. Steve used this as an opportunity to discuss Mike's case and express his belief that drugs may have played a role in his brother's disappearance. After providing a link to Mike's profile page at the Charlie Project, Mike wrote, quote, "What the report doesn't mention is that Mike's friends verified that he had been attending raves and experimenting with different drugs, most notably ecstasy, in the weeks before his disappearance. My personal theory is that he was under the influence of ecstasy or some other substance, left the dorm for whatever reason, and was picked up by one of those people your mother warned you about." End quote. Steve also wrote that Mike was very athletic and capable of defending himself, adding, quote, "To me, the only explanation is one that involves him being out of his right mind, and the simplest cause for that is drugs and alcohol." End quote. It's also worth mentioning that by this point, Steve had become the sound engineer and tech director for the San Diego-based musical act Steam Powered Giraffe, so he closed off his Tumblr post by writing, quote, "I miss you, Mike. I wish you could be here to see what I've accomplished in my aspirations to be like you." End quote. Much like the Find Mike Now website, Steve's original post has since been taken down, but but can still be viewed by the Wayback Machine. Unfortunately, it seems like there have not been any new leads or media coverage for the case in quite some time, so after nearly 24 years, there's still no conclusive answers about what actually happened to Michael Negrete. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So I'm fairly comfortable saying that this is one of the most baffling missing persons cases you'll ever find. I first became familiar with this story when I featured it in an article I published for listverse.com 10 years ago, titled 10 People Who Vanished into Thin Air. I included some other high-profile cases on that list in which there has been no shortage of material, such as the disappearances of Maura Murray and Brian Schaefer, but surprisingly, there isn't all that much material in Michael Negrete's case. Even though I got a decent amount of media coverage in the years following Mike's disappearance, and his family was very active with spreading awareness about his story, it almost seems to have faded from the spotlight. But of course, there has been no shortage of discussion and speculation about this case online, because the whole thing does not make much sense and seems to defy all logic. Now, getting back to the Brian Schaefer disappearance, which took place in Columbus, Ohio in 2006, the main reason his case has generated so much discussion is because he seemingly vanished from a crowded bar, and for years, the narrative that was spread is that the bar's cameras failed to capture him leaving, so how is this disappearance even physically possible? But in retrospect, it seems like this detail about the cameras was greatly exaggerated, and that Brian could have exited the bar without being captured in any footage. Sometimes, the spreading of misinformation can cause a cold case to seem more mysterious than it really is, and this logic also applies to Michael Negrete's disappearance. For instance, if you search through online discussions of this case, you'll find a lot of people who seem to believe that there was security camera footage of Mike leaving Dykstra Hall on the night he went missing, and some of them are even certain that they've seen this footage at one point on a TV show or something. But from all my research, I have not found one legitimate source that confirms that any surveillance footage of Mike actually exists, so this appears to be one of these cases where a piece of false information has been repeated and spread around so much that it becomes accepted as fact. There also seem to be people who believe that Mike left the dorm and went outside while he was barefoot, which would certainly be an odd detail if true, but this has never been conclusively confirmed either. Just because Mike left behind his shoes in his room does not necessarily mean he was barefoot, and in fact, it's been reported that Mike disliked bare feet in general. Most sources you'll find state that the last time Mike was confirmed to be alive was when he spoke to one of his friends inside Dykstra Hall at around 4 a.m., but the actual circumstances of how or when Mike left the dorm are still a big mystery. Mike was noticed to be missing when his roommate woke up at 9 a.m., and realized Mike was not there, but anything could have happened to him during that 5-hour window. So there's a public Facebook group about this case titled Help Find Mike Negrete, and some of the older threads there contain comments from William Howell, a former investigator from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department who worked on this case. During his comments, Howell was able to provide clarification on a number of different issues, such as the aforementioned controversy with Mike's shoes. Howell claims that when Mike was last seen, he was dressed in a plain t-shirt, shorts, and slippers. So no, Mike was not barefoot, though he did not appear to be dressed like someone who had plans to travel somewhere. But curiously, Howell also says in numerous comments that the last person to see Mike alive witnessed him walk out of the dorm's front door alone at 4:28 a.m. while dressed in a t-shirt, shorts, and slippers, even though the temperatures that morning were quite cold. If true, then it sounds like investigators were able to turn up a credible witness who confirmed they saw Mike leaving Dykstra Hall. Another big question people have always had is whether Mike's computer from his dorm room was ever analyzed, as one of the more prominent theories is that Mike may have been secretly communicating with someone online and felt compelled to leave the dorm and meet them before he disappeared. Well, according to Howell's comments, the FBI briefly became involved in the investigation, and were supposed to perform an analysis of Mike's computer, but they somehow wound up corrupting the hard drive so it cannot be reconstructed. I get the impression that if there was anything on that hard drive which could have shed some light on what happened to Mike, no one ever saw it. Now, in regards to Steve Negretti's Tumblr post about Mike allegedly experimenting with ecstasy, Hal claims that the investigation never uncovered any evidence that Mike was involved in drugs, and the most they ever heard is that Mike may have tried ecstasy once, though even that cannot be officially confirmed. Other interesting pieces of information that Hal shared in his comments is that the findings of the police bloodhound who tracked Mike's scent were likely unreliable because the scene had been contaminated before the dog was used, and the composite sketch of the unidentified man seen in Dykstra Hall was a dead end, and the witness who saw him was mistaken. Well, as we go along, I'm going to address each of these points which were shared by Howell, but I want to start off by discussing the composite sketch. Even though the guy in the sketch looks like your standard, generic, 30-something white male, online sleuths have pointed out that he bears a resemblance to two particular individuals. One of them is Mark Collins Rector, who owned a media company called the Digital Entertainment Network, whose headquarters were located just over 3 miles away from the UCLA campus at that time. I won't delve too much into Collins Rector's background, but he is a convicted sex offender who has sexually assaulted teenage boys, and given the close proximity of his headquarters to UCLA, and the fact that Collins Rector was into online video games, there has been rumor mongering that he may have used this as a method to groom Mike and lure him away from Dykstra Hall, which is why some people believe that Collins Rector might be the man in the composite sketch. The other candidate to be this man is Damon Van Dam, whose 7-year-old daughter, Danielle Van Dam, was abducted from her family's home in the Sabre Springs neighborhood of San Diego on February the 1st, 2002. After Danielle's body was found, the perpetrator was identified as a 49-year-old neighbor named David Westerfield, who was subsequently charged, convicted, and sentenced to death for Danielle's murder. It's been reported that Damon Van Dam may have been a friend or co-worker of Mike's father, Miguel Negretti, as the Negretti family also lived in the Sabre Springs neighborhood. Admittedly, Damon does bear a resemblance to the man in the sketch, so there is a blog out there which has pushed forward the idea that Damon may have been responsible for Mike's disappearance. But the problem is that this blog appears to be a biased, pro-innocence website for David Westerfield, even though the evidence that he murdered Danielle Van Dam is overwhelming. So it looks like whoever runs this blog is trying to generate reasonable doubt by pushing forward the idea that Damon was Danielle's real killer and may have been responsible for murdering other people, including Michael Negretti. But I think this whole scenario is completely absurd and sounds like nothing more than a shameless attempt to smear the reputation of a father who lost his daughter. The only reason I even brought this up in the first place is because Damon Van Dam's name often gets mentioned in online discussions about this case, but I totally discount any connection, and I believe the theory of Mark Collins Rector being the man at Dykstra Hall is a major stretch as well. And besides, if what William Howell said is accurate, and the sighting of this man was nothing more than a red herring, then trying to figure out the identity of the guy in the composite sketch is a moot point anyway. To tell you the truth, even before I read Howell's comments, I was always skeptical of the veracity of this lead, because it only came out after investigators distributed some questionnaires to the former residents of Dykstra Hall 6 months after Mike originally went missing. So how reliable could this student's memory have been? Granted, if you see a 30-something man inside a university dormitory for 18 and 19-year-olds at 4:35 in the morning, that is probably going to be unusual enough to stand out, but given the amount of time that passed, the witness could have easily misread or misremembered the whole situation. During his comments, Howell complained that a number of students who lived in Dykstra Hall at the time of Mike's disappearance were not particularly useful or cooperative with investigators, but I'll get back to that topic momentarily. So I mentioned earlier that the San Diego Union-Tribune article published in December of 2000 reported that police had not completely discounted a witness who said they saw someone dressed similar to Mike outside Dykstra Hall at around 4:35 a.m. If the witness accurately described Mike's clothing as shorts, a short-sleeved shirt, and slippers, then this might be one reason investigators found them to be credible. This would suggest that Mike had only planned to step outside the dormitory for a very brief window of time, which could explain why he didn't take anything along with him, including his wallet. It's odd that he didn't take his keys with him, since he would have needed them to get back into the building, but perhaps he simply forgot them, and something happened to him before he could make his way back inside. But of course, this still wouldn't explain why he felt compelled to go outside at 4:30 in the morning to begin with. If Mike wasn't planning on going anywhere, this certainly does lend credence to the idea that the findings of the bloodhound who tracked his scent to the bus stop are not reliable. Even if Mike really wanted to catch a bus at 4:30, it makes no sense for him to walk all the way to the intersection of Sunset Boulevard and Bellagio Street, since there were at least 3 bus stops on campus which were closer. I guess the only reason Mike would have to go to that specific location is if he was planning to meet someone there and the scent came to an end because that person took him away from the scene in a vehicle. It's also very odd that the bloodhound tracked Mike's scent in a zigzag direction around campus. This could mean that he was very drunk and did not know where he was going, but I don't get the impression that Mike got intoxicated that night, so perhaps he was walking alongside another person and they were just kind of randomly wandering around the campus while they were conversing. When Howell said the scene was contaminated, I get the impression he's referring to Mike's dorm room, as the bloodhound may have originally picked up Mike's scent from there, but if a number of people had frequented the room before the dog did, that could have caused the contamination. For instance, perhaps the bloodhound was unknowingly tracking the scent of Mike's roommate and following a route that he had taken on a previous occasion. Or perhaps the dog was tracking Mike's scent from when he walked that route on another occasion prior to his disappearance. So much like the sighting of the man in Dykstra Hall, perhaps the findings of the bloodhound are just another red herring in this case. However, to get a better understanding of what Mike may or may not have done on this particular morning, we have to discuss his background, as well as the events in his life prior to his disappearance. Mike's family has always maintained that he had no personal problems and no signs of being suicidal or depressed, and his last communication to them was sharing his plans to return home for the holidays. I mean, theoretically, if Mike was feeling suicidal, that would explain a lot about why he left his dorm without appropriate clothing and never bothered to take his keys and wallet along with him, as he may have been planning to end his own life and had no intention of ever coming back. But even if that was the case, what happened to Mike's body? Were there any nearby places he could have gone to kill himself where his remains would not be discovered for nearly 24 years? While suicidal people can sometimes do unpredictable things, Mike's behavior before he went missing did not give off any red flags, as he spent most of the night partying, hanging out with friends, and playing an online video game. While academic pressure can sometimes drive students to suicide, it sounds like Mike was doing very well during his first semester, so unless there's additional evidence we don't know about, I think we can rule out the suicide option. And of course, I think there's virtually zero chance that Mike disappeared to start a new life. Since the authorities eventually announced that they were investigating Mike's disappearance as a potential homicide, the most likely theory is that he became the victim of foul play, but how would these events have played out? But before we explore that angle, one additional theory I've often seen pushed forward is that Mike's death was accidental, as there was a lot of construction taking place on the UCLA campus at that time. Yes, investigators did check a number of these construction sites and found nothing, but could he have stumbled into a dangerous area and accidentally wound up dead? Is there a possibility that some of the construction work unknowingly concealed his body and have prevented it from ever being found? Well, there is precedent for scenarios where university students went missing on campus and died in a tragic accident. During the early morning hours of January the 13th, 2007, 19-year-old freshman Wade Steffi vanished after leaving a fraternity party at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. Wade remained a missing person for the next 2 months until his body was discovered behind a transformer inside a high-voltage utility room at a residence hall on campus. Wade had gotten intoxicated at the frat party and presumably wandered into the utility room and accidentally electrocuted himself on the transformer, and his body was so well concealed that some initial searches for Wade failed to notice him. But of course, there's a major difference between a victim's body going unnoticed for 2 months rather than 24 years, so if Mike suffered an accidental death on campus, would he really manage to remain undiscovered for that long? I've seen the theory about construction projects accidentally concealing a body being pushed forward in a number of unsolved missing persons cases, such as the disappearance of Joan Risch and my recent episode about the lost boys of Hannibal, but unless the victim's body was incredibly hard to notice, it would take some very incompetent construction crews to do something like this. There's also the fact that unlike Wade Steffi, it does not appear that Mike was intoxicated at the time he disappeared. While he may have drank margaritas at the dorm party he attended, Mike then went back to his room and spent the next several hours playing an online video game, which does not point to him being drunk and not having all of his faculties. Now, in Wade Steffi's case, he was refused entry to the residence hall after he left the frat party, so he likely went inside the utility room to attempt to find a way to sneak back in. Since Mike left his keys in his room, it's not impossible that he could have locked himself out of Dykstra Hall and suffered some sort of accident when he tried to find a way back in, but again, could his body really remain undiscovered for 24 years? But while we're on the subject of getting intoxicated, we have to address the possibility that Mike's disappearance could be related to drugs. The drug angle was never publicly brought up until Mike's brother Steve made that Tumblr post in 2013, which mentioned that Mike had been experimenting with ecstasy. Steve does seem to believe that Mike was under the influence of ecstasy or some other drug when he left the dorm before something bad happened to him. This claim is countered during the comments from William Howell, who said that over the course of the investigation, they only received information that Mike may have tried ecstasy once. Well, Steve wrote that his family received this information about the ecstasy from Mike's friends, so I'm sure the Negrettis know a lot more about this angle than has been released publicly, and it's not hard to believe that Mike's friends would have been more forthcoming about his drug use with his family rather than the police. After all, Howell also said that some of the other students at Dykstra Hall were not particularly cooperative with the police, and I can totally understand them being reluctant to share everything they knew if drugs were involved. While Steve thinks that his brother may have been under the influence of ecstasy when he disappeared, the alternate theory is that Mike stepped outside in order to score some ecstasy or other drugs from someone, but he wound up becoming the victim of foul play. But my big issue is that 4:30 in the morning seems like a very odd time to do that. I'm also a bit skeptical that Mike was on ecstasy at the time he went missing, since he had spent the past several hours playing an online game on his computer. Granted, I'm definitely not an expert on being under the influence of ecstasy, but people generally take that drug when they're attending raves or parties or other group events, rather than when they're sitting alone in their room in front of a computer. All that being said, I would be really curious to know what information the Negrettis family received to make Steve think that Mike was on drugs when he vanished. So one of the last known persons to see Mike alive was the friend he had been playing the online game with, as Mike reportedly left his room and briefly met up with his friend to congratulate him on winning. I always used to assume that this was the last confirmed sighting of Mike until I read Howell's comments about someone having seen Mike leave Dykstra Hall at 4:28 a.m. And of course, Mike also had a roommate who was sleeping when he went missing and did not wake up until just under 5 hours after Mike was last seen. The names of the friend and the roommate have never been released publicly, and perhaps inevitably, there's always been speculation that they may have known more about Mike's disappearance than they were letting on. Even though Hal has said that many of the students from the dorm were not as forthcoming or cooperative with investigators as they should have been, he also acknowledged that they were likely preoccupied with other events in their own lives, since this was when exams were taking place. But like I mentioned earlier, even if these students appeared evasive to law enforcement, this may have had more to do with the fact that they were reluctant to open up about other indiscretions which were taking place, such as underage drinking and drug use. So this does not necessarily mean they had any knowledge or involvement in Mike's disappearance. Theories have always been pushed forward that something may have happened to Mike inside Dykstra Hall, such as an accidental overdose, so some other students orchestrated a cover-up and disposed of his body. Well, if Mike had gone missing while attending a party at a private residence or something, I might have an easier time believing this theory, but I just can't imagine young university students being able to smuggle Mike's body out of the 6th floor of a dormitory without anyone seeing anything. Yes, his disappearance took place at around 4 to 4:30 a.m. when most people would have been sleeping, but as I can attest from my own university experience, students are often awake at odd hours in dormitories. Mike went missing during the early morning hours of a Friday, and at many universities, it's fairly common for Thursday nights to be the big party night, where people go out drinking, since Friday classes are not all that common. At this particular point in December, classes would have been over at UCLA, so I'm not surprised that Mike attended a residence party on a Thursday night, as the students likely decided to cut loose one last time before exams started. For this reason, I do not find it unusual at all that Mike would still be awake at 4 a.m., and I would not be surprised if other residents at the dorm were still awake at that hour. So I think it would have been really difficult for a student or a group of students to cover up Mike's death and smuggle his body outside unnoticed. And even if something like that did happen, I cannot imagine all these people being able to keep their mouth shut about it for nearly 24 years. This is why I'm inclined to believe that whatever did happen to Mike took place outside Dykstra Hall. Given that Mike spent his last hours on the university's intranet playing games, I still wonder if he might have communicated with someone and made arrangements to step outside and meet them at this odd hour. I know this was 1999, so the internet was nowhere near as high-tech as it is today, but people could still communicate with each other online. This is why it's a major shame that the FBI supposedly corrupted the hard drive on Mike's computer, because it may have had the key to shedding some light on what happened to him. I've seen a lot of online speculation that Mike may have decided to leave the dorm for some sort of sexual hookup, and since Mike did not have a girlfriend at that time, people have wondered if he might have been secretly gay. But there's no concrete evidence to support any of these scenarios, and if Mike did leave for some sort of sexual encounter, it still doesn't make much sense that he would leave without his keys. If Mike was communicating with someone online, I do think it's possible that this person convinced him to step outside, but even though Mike figured that the meeting would only be a brief one, this individual took Mike away from the scene and harmed him. It's possible that the Negretti family and law enforcement know enough information to have their own ideas about what happened to Mike, but to the rest of us, it almost appears as if he literally vanished into thin air. Myself, I lean towards the idea that someone lured Mike out of the dormitory and harmed him, but I have zero idea who this person could have been or what their motive was. Until we receive more concrete answers, this will continue to remain one of the most baffling missing persons cases of the modern era. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Michael Negretti, please contact either the UCLA Police Department at 310-825-1491 or the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office at 323-890-5500. Once again, either contact the UCLA Police Department at 310-825-1491 or the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department at 325-890-5500. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives. This past month, I released an episode titled The 10 Dumbest Segments on Unsolved Mysteries, where I discussed some of the silliest so-called mysteries that were featured on the show. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unexplained 1988 disappearance of a ship called the Freedon, which vanished during a trip through the Caribbean from Florida to Haiti. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. Also, if we manage to attain our goal of reaching 500 Patreon subscribers by the end of October, we'll also be providing an additional extra special bonus for patrons in November. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon these past several weeks, and they are Lauren R., Jenny K., Rue Lurkin, Maya C., Chris T., Patsy M., Lauren Y., Lauren D., Carol L., and Sean D. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, Severed Affair, The Gruesome Murder of Shad Therion.
Wisconsin has had more than its fair share of horrific murders and high-profile criminal cases. From the notorious Jeffrey Dahmer to the gruesome Ed Gein. On a cold night in February 2022, another name was added to the list of Wisconsin's worst. Taylor Shabusiness.
Tara had woken me up, said she found my son's head in a bucket. I'm dumbfounded. Didn't believe her. Thought she was having a mental issue or something.
From the outset, the details of the case shocked even the most hardened detectives and traumatized young rookies.
If we could get more answers sooner rather than later, that'd be appreciated. We've got quite a bit of blood down here.
Law and Crime has reported on the case from the beginning. Using Law and Crime's gavel-to-gavel coverage, we've woven an in-depth narrative.
I went downstairs. At the bottom of the stairs to the right, there was a green bucket with a shower towel on top of it. Lifted the towel off, and there was, in fact, a human severed head in the bucket.
Severed Affair. The Gruesome Murder of Shad Therion is a Law and Crime original podcast that uses exclusive audio and court footage to piece together the story.
Beyond the stack of mattresses, there appeared to be blood on the floor and then small chunks of human flesh.
You can listen to Severed Affair exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which have a number of interesting discussions about today's featured case. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us again next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.